Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Achtung, Achtung, welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk, the Second World War podcast of choice for the discerning listener. With me, Al Murray and James Holland, and we are about to, well, we're going to talk about the Battle of Monte Cassino, or the Battles of Monte Cassino, in this little series that we're doing for you today. And James, should we start with a quote?
I think so, and I think it's, you know, this is Churchill, so I think it's only right that you should do it.
What also could be more dangerous than to let the Italian battle stagnate and fester on for another 3 months? We cannot afford to go forward, leaving a vast, half-finished job behind us. It therefore seemed to those present that every effort should be made to bring off Anzio on a two-division basis around January 20th, and orders have been issued to General Alexander to prepare accordingly. If this opportunity is not grasped, we must expect the ruin of the Mediterranean campaigns in 1944.
So, oh, bravo. I mean, that's just absolutely magnificent. Could it be anyone else? Yeah, so Churchill getting hot under the collar in December 1943. About the stagnation of the Italian campaign.
I didn't get to say Nazi, Jim.
The Nazi menace.
you got it in. But really, if we're brutally honest about it, it's the Battle for Rome, which has begun already back in September 1943 when the Allies invade Italy, but it is very much the focus here. It's get to Rome quickly. And this is the focus of our episode because we're also going to include the Battle of Anzio, as that quote implies. And Cassino and Monte Cassino. Cassino is the town, Monte Cassino is the mountain. You know, these are all different things. And there's battles raging other parts of that front that aren't at Cassino. So it's a bit of a misnomer, but we all know what we're talking about. So this is the 6 months of January to June 1944 that we're going to be covering, 80th anniversary of.
Which raises the immediate question, why Rome? Why is this the battle for Rome? What's the grand strategy here that means you're... Because Monte Cassino dominates the people's imaginations in the way it dominated the battlefield as a landmark, as a piece of geography. But why Rome? Why are the Allies hung up on the Italian capital at this stage?
Yes, and why Rome, and why are they in Italy in the first place? And to go to Italy in the first place, you have to go back to the Italians invading Libya in September 1940, which prompts the start of the Mediterranean campaign. Italians have declared war on Britain. Britain responds to that. Italians get trounced by the beginning of 1941. So the Germans then come to the rescue of the Italians and get drawn into the Mediterranean campaign themselves. That goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Americans then enter the war in December 1941. They're committed to the Russians, to getting involved with the Germans on the ground in some point in 1942. It becomes absolutely clear that a cross-channel invasion is not going to happen. So Churchill comes up with his idea, says, look, we're already in North Africa. We're moving from the east to the west, from Egypt towards Libya. Why don't we land a joint Anglo-US force in Northwest Africa? We can meet in the middle and squeeze out the German forces. That all happens, Operation Torch, November 1942, and it all comes to fruit. And May 1943, the Tunisian campaign is over, and with it, the Allies become the masters of the North African shores, etc. Once you've got that, you've now got these huge forces, combined Anglo-American forces in the Mediterranean. You might as well do something about it. Again, going across the channel for Operation Overlord isn't a goer in 1943. So they then think, well, let's go into Sicily. That's an obvious one. And maybe we can knock Italy out of the war and, you know, see where it all goes. And then we've got a foothold in Europe, blah, blah, blah. So they do that in July 1943. That's a complete success, completes in August 17th, 1943. At which point, you know, they're then thinking, well, we've now set Operation Overlord, the cross-channel invasion, for the beginning of May 1944, as it is at that stage. What are we going to do? You know, we've still got all these forces here. We might as well do something. And actually going into Italy would be a really good idea, because that would then draw off German troops from the Eastern Front, but particularly the Western Front. So there'll be fewer troops opposing Operation Overlord when that happens in May 1944. So that would be a big tick, because Italian troops are occupying the whole of the Balkans, Greece, the Aegean, as well as Italy. So either the Germans are going to have to abandon that if Italy's out of the war, or they're going to have to replace them. Secondly, there's a whole load of airfields around this area called Foggia, which is on the Adriatic coast, the eastern coast, about a third of the way up the leg of Italy, where you can put in heavy bombers and you can further tighten the strategic air noose, bombing noose around Nazi Germany.
And it's known that, in fact, in the invasion of Sicily has drawn troops away from the Eastern Front. So the effect is, this isn't an imagined effect. This is a concrete effect. You know, the Kursk offensive is called off because of the invasion of Sicily, or diluted, isn't it?
Hitler absolutely
dilutes his Eastern Front commitments because of what's happening in the Mediterranean. So it works. We know, they know it. The Allies know it works. So this isn't some punt based on a hunch. This isn't just because I think very often the immediate thing people maybe know about the Italian campaign is this idea: it's the soft underbelly that turned out not to be soft. It's the
Soft underbelly of Europe
and all that, Turns out that Churchill was wrong about that. But actually, it is more than that. It is about drawing Germans away because they know that works.
Well, and because Hitler is obsessed with the Southern Front.
Yes. They've managed to, and the Allies have managed to persuade him that his obsession is not wrong-headed, with a vast array of deception stuff and chatter, and also by fighting him there and defeating him there and showing, in a peculiar way, proving him right by fighting him there. You know, that theatre is important because otherwise why would they turn up and fight him there? You know, the strategic logic that he offers them. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, in a way that Allied strategic logic in this instance is in its own peculiar way shaped by Hitler's reasoning. And Hitler's reasoning kind of is, I must fight my enemies wherever I find them, rather than, you know what, that's a really bad idea.
Well, I mean, but it's also because his only source of oil is in Ploiești in Romania, and that's within spitting, it's still a long way away, but it's closer to the Allies in Italy than it is to the Allies operating out of England. So, you know, there's that to be protected. And you know, you can get through the Alps up into Austria and into southern Germany from Italy and from the Balkans and stuff. So, you know, he's right that it's that Germany is vulnerable. And that's one of the major problems that Germany has, is it lies in the heart of Europe and it's open from attack from north, south, east and west. So he is nervous about it. And the other reason for going in there, so you've got knock Italy out of the war once and for all. Well, that happens very quickly. Get the Foggia airfields, draw off German troops, and get to Rome, and Rome being a major capital. And the presumption is, and this is from very spurious intelligence, but intelligence nonetheless, and it happens to be correct, that Hitler is planning to retreat to the Pisa-Rimini line should the Allies invade. And indeed he is. And the Pisa-Rimini line is about 200 miles north of Rome, and this goes across the leg of Italy, and it's the one point in the whole of the Italian peninsula where the mountains really kiss the Tyrrhenian coast and the Adriatic coast without a break. So it's the strongest single defensive line of continuous mountains anywhere in Italy. So it makes very, very good sense to do that.
So as a defender, you couldn't ask for anything more, really?
You couldn't ask for anything more. And Rommel is originally going to be his earmarked to command this. And this is in the summer of 1943 when they're planning this. And his point is, look, I've fought against the British. I fought against the Allies. I know what they're like. They've got loads of air power.
And lost.
Yeah, and the 6,000 destroyed Luftwaffe aircraft between, you know, November 1942 to September 1943 is evidence of that air power. You know, you want the shortest lines of communication you can possibly manage.
Yeah.
So the further you are into Italy, the further you know, the kind of more exposed you are.
So hang on, Jim. So we've talked about Hitler's strategic view of things. Who are his actors in the Italian theatre? So we've Rommel. And again, what's going to become apparent is that the German way of doing things is having people fighting like rats in the sack with the, essentially with overlapping jobs, with overlapping interpretations, overlapping ways of pleasing the or working towards the Führer, reading Hitler's mind somehow and giving him what he wants. So who are the German key players in Italy?
Well, to start off with, it is Rommel, who is commander of Army Group B, which is up in the north of Italy, and he's working completely on the assumption that the build-up of German troops in northern Italy is going to be under his command, and it's going to kind of stop at the Pisa-Rimini line. But in southern Italy is Field Marshal Albert Kesselring, who's a Luftwaffe Field Marshal, but has taken on a ground role and has become the commander of Army Group C, which is all German forces in the south. And there have been German forces in the south because they're, you know, around Rome and because they've come back across the Straits of Messina from Sicily, from the Sicilian campaign. So they're already there. What happens is the Allies do invade on, first of all, on the 3rd of September 1943 across the Straits of Messina from Sicily, where it is very mountainous and progress is slow. But the main event is Operation Avalanche, which is Salerno on the 9th of September. And Kesselring and his German troops contest this very strongly. The Allies prevail, but Hitler has been impressed by this and so decides that actually he's going to change his mind. And rather than going to the Pisa-Rimini line, he now wants them to fight for every yard. The problem is that on the 27th of September 1943, the Germans abandon the Foggia airfields, which is the most important bit of territory, ground in Italy, south of Rome, by, you know, from a strategic point of view, by a country mile. So having lost Foggia very, very swiftly, there is now no point in fighting south of Rome. That, you know, the only reason for fighting south of Rome is to safeguard Foggia, because otherwise it's just not worth it. It's too much hassle. It's too much commitment. That it is going to draw off too many troops from other theatres. Whereas if they just do a kind of fighting retreat and really build up the strength of the Pisa-Rimini line, then they've got a bastion through which, you know, the Allies are really going to struggle to get through anytime soon. So, but be that as may, Hitler changed his mind.
Yeah, exactly. But and if you've spent men on not doing that, as it were, when that moment comes, you've got less people to do the defending, right? So everything has its cost. Everything represents an opportunity cost if you're defending in this situation. And why, just briefly, before we get on to who the Allies are in this, because after
we'll go on to that.
One of the striking things about this campaign is it's truly multinational. And certainly by the end of the Italian campaign, it's basically Uncle Tom, Uncle Tom Cobbley and all. It's basically everyone imaginable in the Allied sort of palette.
Including the Brazilians.
Yeah. Including the Brazilians. I mean, it's extraordinary. Why is a Luftwaffe general? You know, why is an Air Force man in a ground role?
Well, because originally his involvement is commanding an air corps to try and neutralize Malta. And then he gets on very well with his Italian compadres and so ends up having a sort of command role in the south, in the Mediterranean, while Rommel is command of German troops in North Africa. And he just stays there. You know, he just remains in theatre. He's very good at dealing with the Italians. He's very diplomatic. And so he ends up with this command role. But the problem is that although he was in the artillery in the First World War, you know, he is very much an administrator and a Luftwaffe man. And although he's, you know, he understands enough about the kind of the military world in which to be that overseeing command role, you know, he's not much of a tactical commander. So that's the kind of the shortcoming. But also he's slavishly devoted to his Hitlerian oath, which is, you know, when you become a senior commander, you have to sign an oath to obey Hitler and all the rest of it. And this has sort of slightly clouded his judgment, I think.
Well, first of all, it's clouded his judgment to the point where he's taken on a ground role, which he's not qualified for.
Well, he's taken on a ground role, which he's not qualified for, but also then making strategic decisions, which actually, from an operational tactical point of view, don't make any sense whatsoever, i.e. fighting south of Rome.
This is like putting Lee Mallory in charge of Eighth Army, right?
Exactly. It really is. I'd say Kesselring's a bit more competent than Lee Mallory, but
let's not get above ourselves.
Get ahead of ourselves here. So suddenly the Allies find themselves, you know, they're assuming that they're going to be able to tick off all these four demands: knocking Italy out of the war, drawing off German troops, getting the Foggia airfields, and getting to Rome in quick order. They do all three within a month. The first three within a month, but they don't get to Rome. And the problem is having got the Foggia airfields, you then need to make sure that you've got enough of a cushion there. Because in terms of divisions, and divisions are the unit by which we judge the scale of armed forces in the Second World War. So if you imagine that as a rule of thumb, a division is 15,000 men, that's the kind of scale we're talking about. And all this time, the Germans have more divisions in Italy than the Allies do. And so the worry is that if you don't keep hammering away and keep pushing and keeping the initiative from a kind of aggressive military point of view, You'll then hand back that initiative to the Germans. They will then counterattack. Because you're on the attack, you haven't got defensive positions. So when they counterattack, you're exposed. You then lose Foggia, for which you've now made vast commitments. So really, you need to be at least 50 miles north of Rome to ensure that your asset at Foggia, your airfields at Foggia, are safe and secure. The problem is that Kesselring creates a very, very strong double-lock defensive system about between sort of 70 and 80 miles south of Rome. The first one is called the Bernhard Line, or the Winter Line, as the Americans call it. And then about 8 miles behind that is the Gustav Line. And it's the Gustav Line which has its strongest position around the town of Cassino, through which the Via Casalina Highway 6 passes through, which is the single biggest, mainest road that goes from kind of the south up to Rome. And towering above it, because the road hugs the valley on the eastern side, on the kind of northeastern side, around the base of the mountains, you've got the Monte Cassino Massive, perched upon the top of which is the famous Benedictine, 6th century Benedictine Abbey, which sort of peers over everyone like sort of Sauron's eye or something. And the problem is, how do you unlock this double lock system? And by the end of December 1943, they've managed to bludgeon their way through the Bernhard Line, the Winter Line, but they haven't even pulled up to the Gustav Line yet. And that's where we're at the beginning of January. And what we should just say is that what you've got is you've got two allied armies in Italy. You've got the US 5th Army and you've got the British 8th Army. But within those armies, is a US 5th Army commanded by Lieutenant General Mark W. Clark, Wayne Clark. He has got American troops. He's got the Corps Expeditionnaire Français, the French Expeditionary Corps, of two divisions. And he's also got the British 10 Corps of two divisions. In 8th Army, you've got the New Zealanders, you've got the Canadians, you've got various other British units, you've got 4th Indian Division arriving, you've got the Poles arriving, the two Polish corps. So even by the end of 1943, it's a truly, truly multinational corps. And there's been very, very bitter fighting in the latter end of 1943 along the Adriatic coast on the 8th Army side. So 8th Army is on the kind of eastern side, Clark's 5th Army is on the western side. And there's been incredibly bitter fighting, but both sides are completely exhausted and it's still quite a long way from Rome. So both sides start to sort of thin out and realize that 5th Army's front around Cassino, around the Gustav Line there, and there's this wide 5 to 6 mile wide Liri Valley between the two peaks. You've got Monte Cassino on the kind of on the northeastern side, and you've got Monte Maio on the southwestern side, and this sort of 5 mile valley of the Liri Valley in between. That becomes very obvious that is the kind of the main event. That's where it's the strongest point of the line, but it's also where your access north with all and with the Allies' preponderance of mechanization, where it can really kind of move forward, is there. So the 8th Army suddenly from January 1944 takes a massive kind of side back step in terms of importance. There's fighting, but it's kind of desultory artillery fire, patrolling, that kind of stuff, but nothing, no sort of major operations. And so suddenly all the influence is there. But the dilemma for the Allies, sorry, is very quickly, and the dilemma for the chiefs of staff, who have after all sanctioned and backed the Italian campaign in the first place, is how on earth do you unlock the system? You know, how do you unlock the stalemate? You know, we've got stuck for 2 months on the Bernhard Line. How are we going to get through and smash our way through to Rome? And we need to do it quick because Operation Overlord is hovering in the wings, still due for May 1944.
Which brings me to what I was just going to say, because one of the things that's been happening, and you can see it in the people in charge of this campaign, you know, 8th Army, up to this point synonymous with Montgomery, people are being siphoned away, aren't they, to Northwest Europe to get ready for the invasion of France. So who's commanding, for those that don't know, Montgomery's gone home to join Cossack to drop the plan. Eisenhower's gone back to the UK.
Yep, so there's a new Supreme Allied Commander.
Exactly, because he's the new Supreme Allied Commander. So there's a change of the guard, isn't there? As well as this army filling up with new units and new bits, people being plugged in this sort of more multinational texture. Because after all, this campaign is often criticised as sort of slow and stuck. Is that because you've got new people and they don't know what they're doing, or is it because that's the nature of the beast here? Because after all, Montgomery is often criticised for being slow and stuck in his method anyway. So what difference does it make if it's him or someone else? Might be the thing around this.
Yeah, so the person who takes over is Lieutenant General Sir Oliver Leese, who is a sort of big, hearty chap who wears plus fours and you know, sort of models himself on a lot of Montgomery's eccentricities, but doesn't quite sort of pull it off in quite the same way. I quite like him because he's a massive cricket fan and later becomes sort of president of the MCC. So I have got a bit of a soft spot for him, but you know, he's kind of sort of avuncular and jocular, but also can be a complete
he can be a very, very difficult person. Yeah,
very, very tricky indeed. Yeah. And he's certainly got an ego on him and all the rest of it.
But
he's really, you know, he's a non-player at the moment. You know, Eighth Army is just doing a holding role being, you know, what's happening is the main event is Fifth Army and Mark Clark's Fifth Army. Mark Clark's only 47 years old at this time. And, you know, still comparatively inexperienced, but he's very tough. He's
very brave.
He's incredibly courageous. It really is courageous. Multiple decorations for gallantry. Battlefield at command experience in the First World War, despite his youth. An absolutely incomparable planner. He's one of these people who just dots I's and crosses T's. So he's a details person. Not everyone is, but he really, really is. And he's got a very sort of clear, I think, kind of strategic view. But he's also a bit hot-headed. He's prickly. He gets his knickers in a twist about things. You know, he worries. You can see he worries a lot and he gets bothered and irritated by people's shortcomings. But up until Christmas 1943, I say this about Montgomery as well as commanding 8th Army, and I would also say this about Alexander, who is the Army group commander. I don't think any of those three really put a foot wrong. I think they do everything right. And Clark actually does a huge amount right with his command at Salerno. Is exceptional, considering that he's never commanded an army in battle before. Last time he commanded a battle was as a subaltern, you know, first lieutenant in France in 1918. So, you know, he really, really steps up. You know, the situation is incredibly challenging.
But briefly, an example of in the Second World War of how brave he is Operation Flagpole, where he goes to, where before Operation Torch, he goes in, he's dropped off by submarine.
Yep. Itself is really, really dangerous.
It's really dangerous. Yeah, completely bonkers. And goes to find out what the Vichy French might do, or tries to find out what the Vichy French might do in the event of an American invasion of North Africa. I mean, and then sits around and waits to be rescued by canoe. So the guy is prepared to put his neck on the block. And I think that's one of the really interesting things about Clark is he's not going to ask anyone to do anything he's not prepared to do himself. He's one of those people, right?
Yep.
Anyway, so those are the main players. And the thing is I think what we've done there is I think we've outlined what their personalities are like without getting stuck, because maybe one of the things people can get quite hung up on Mark Clark. I think it's interesting to get hung up on Mark Clark rather than Albert Kessering, but there we go.
So we should just before we go to the break, very quickly, we should also just mention Alexander. I mean, obviously I've mentioned before on this podcast that he's a great hero of mine. I mean, he is an exceptional guy. He is without a shadow of doubt the single most combat experienced commander on any side in the Second World War. He's the only commander to have, he ends up a field marshal. He's the only one to command troops in combat at every step of the ranks available. He's commanded German troops in the Baltic Landwehr in 1919. You know, he's incredibly decorated. He speaks seven languages. He's an artist as well. You know, he's a consummate diplomat, extremely charming. He's not a details person. You know, he's not like that in the way that Clark is. But in terms of someone you want to have as an overall commander with the ability to come up with a strategic vision for the campaign, whilst at the same time handling multinational troops in you know, what is the purest form coalition imaginable, he's your man, and he's absolutely the right person for this.
So that's the overview. That's the people who have the overview. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to bat at the Gustav line, aren't we, Jim?
We certainly are. We're going to try and get up to it, first of all.
We'll see you in a moment.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. where already the ambitious plans, it's not unlike the Italian campaign, this, ambitious plans to complete...
We got bogged down in the first half. We were going to complete
this in four episodes, and now plainly we're not going to get to Rome for five. So, I mean...
Dare I say it's six.
I mean, we're basically staying entirely in character for this then.
Right, yes. So what I would say, you asked me, you said, but why is it? Is it because they're incompetent, or is it the situation? The reason why they're not in Rome for Christmas is twofold. First, it's because Kesselring decides to fight, you know, and Hitler then backs him to the hilt and then insists upon it that they fight south of Rome. So you've got this double lock system of the Bernhard line followed by the Gustav line. The second reason is because the Allies are incredibly mechanized. You know, they put, as we've discussed many times on this podcast, a huge amount of emphasis is put on air power, tactical air power, which is you know, air power supporting ground operations. So you've got strategic air power, which is bombers going off and operating independently of any ground forces and bombing cities or factories or whatever.
Yeah. Yep.
And then and then you've got tactical air power, which is directly supporting operations on the ground.
Yep.
So, you know, diving down and bombing a machine gun post or an artillery position or whatever it might be, or a bridge or something. But because the weather has turned so badly at the beginning of October...
You don't have the tactical air power.
You can have air power, but you can only have air power on sunny days, and it rains 50% of every minute between the 1st of October and the 31st of December. And on top of that, so that massively restricts their ability to operate. The second thing, of course, is just rains and rains and rains, which then turns up all the roads, which makes the valleys a nightmare for all their mechanization.
Well, what roads there are, after all, we're not looking at Autobahn.
And not even in high summer, but they're certainly not in kind of, you know, deepest, darkest winter where it's raining all the time. And there's lots and lots of mountains. And the big problem is the Germans put artillery observers on the top of mountains, because from the top of mountains, you can see everything. So then they can direct artillery fire onto those roads in the valley. And so the Allies can't pass through those roads on the valley, because they'll all be destroyed by artillery fire, until they've cleared the artillery fire. And the only way you can do that is by prizing the observers off the top of the mountains. But obviously, if you're going to put an observer on the top of the mountains, you then surround them by infantry and mortars and so on, and mines and wire. So the job of the Allies is to get to the top of those mountains and prize off those German protective infantry and prize off the observers. Then they can start using their own artillery to destroy the German artillery, and then they can move forward. But if you imagine, you know, the whole of the width of Italy is just solid mountains, and it's winter, and it's raining, and the days are short, and there's lots and lots of mud in the valleys. Suddenly, why this all sort of grinds to a halt, you can start to understand why. But because the whole point of the campaign was that this would be done quickly, because it was based on the assumption that the Germans are going to retreat north, suddenly there's this sort of air of disappointment. And what happens at the end of December 1943 is the Tehran Conference, or rather the beginning of December 1943, which is the first Allied conference where they act, you know, the chiefs of staff of America and Britain and Roosevelt and Churchill, Roosevelt being obviously the President of the United States, Churchill being the Prime Minister of Great Britain, are together with Stalin and his equivalent chiefs. And Stalin says, you've got to do Overlord, i.e. the cross-channel invasion, but you should also at the same time do an invasion of southern France. And the Americans rather latch onto this. So this has been codenamed Operation Anvil. And as things stand at the end of December 1943, Anvil is to take place the same time as Overlord at the beginning of May. And therein lies the whole rub.
Because that's impossible.
It's impossible to do everything, and you haven't got enough shipping. Yeah. But how do you unlock the Gustav line? You've just battered for 2 months against the Bernhard line and got through that. Yep. So how you've now got an even stronger line again. How are you going to get through and get to Rome quickly before Overlord? And they want to get it done before Overlord because they want to draw off more German troops, and they want to make sure that the Foggia airfields are secure. And they've got this job of trying to get rid of control of the airspace over Northwest Europe so that they can conduct Operation Overlord safely without interference from the Luftwaffe, etc., etc. So Italy is completely tied in to Operation Overlord. And so there is this plan that has been hatched, which has first been put forward at the kind of, I think it's back end of November, to do an amphibious assault around the back of the German front line and unlock it that way. And this then gets abandoned because they're not far forward enough in December, but it is now resurrected again over Christmas 1943 by Churchill, who's recovering from pneumonia in Carthage. and suddenly thinks, well, hang on a minute, you know, we've got all these landing craft. And if we're now going to do Anvil as well, then presumably that means we're going to have to leave some landing craft here in the Mediterranean. And I know we've got to send a whole load of 67 landing ships to back to the UK for Overlord, but all these crews are really well trained. So perhaps they don't need quite so long back in the UK, and perhaps we can hold on to them a bit long, and perhaps we can do a little operation. And maybe we could land, I don't know, what about Anzio? That looks like a good place. It's kind of, you know, 30 miles south of Rome. That would be good. And then, you know, that might unlock the whole Gustav line, because the Germans will suddenly think, crikey, there's some Allied troops at my rear. The best thing to do is to just pull back completely to save it being unfolded. And if you do a concerted double effort of hammering against the Gustav line from the south, whilst at the same time putting a corps-size invasion force behind that line, maybe that will trigger the Germans to pull back. And surely that's got to be worth the punt.
Yeah, yeah. If you look at it on the map, if you look at it in raw terms of how do we literally circumvent this problem, which is what that's literally what they're trying to do, you look at it like that, it makes complete sense, Anzio. And after all, it's bringing to bear Allied advantage. And Allied advantage is that you have amphibious assault forces. You can do this. If the Germans were able to do this, this is the sort of thing they do. You're trying to inject movement into a static situation. It's completely logical, and it's within the Allied way of war. So what you do, as you say, Jim, the Allied way of war is about mechanization. So you dollop up another chunk of a mechanized army somewhere else that can then move. And in a way, it echoes the Italian campaign. We'll draw soldiers off to here. We'll put some somewhere else, which will draw them off to there. And one way or another, we'll make progress.
Yes, and it's also very much the Allied way to have a two-fisted punch.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You know, you attack one thing and then you kind of pack one the other.
Because you can.
But the other reason why Italy has failed is because so much emphasis has been put on building up the strategic air forces at Foggia that there isn't enough shipping space capacity to support the ground forces in the way that they've wanted to be supported. So the fault for any failings of the Italian campaign up to the end of 1943 does not lie with Alexander or Clark or Montgomery. It lies with the combined chiefs of staff who've committed to Italy in the first place but under-resourced it. And it is a problem of their making, not those who are on the ground in Italy.
It is within the Allied way of doing things, a two-fisted punch. But if you're not, after all, Italy and Overlord are a two-fisted punch, and in themselves, aren't they? That's the idea.
Yes.
And if you underfund one of the punches, it's going to get stuck. And then Anzio and the Gustav Line offensives are a two-fisted punch. And if you underfund one of, you know, it's the same. It's an echo of itself, that the problem, the grand problem, is echoed smaller and then echoed on each level, because after all, you can't have everything.
Yeah, that absolutely is the case. And, you know, you're absolutely right saying this is the obvious thing to do, because, and that's exactly what the Germans are expecting. So we should also say that by this point, Rommel has been packed off a long time ago, back in October to command Army Group B in Northwest Europe in the Atlantic Wall. And that's why he ends up opposing the Allied invasion of Normandy in June 1944 when it finally comes. Kesselring has been given overall command of Italy, and that comes with two armies. 10th Army, AOK 10, Army Oberkommando 10, and Army Oberkommando 14. And 14 is split up all over the place and is in the north. And this is commanded by von Mackensen, and 10th Army is commanded by von Vatinghoff. And it is 10th Army that the Allies have been battling so far in the Italian campaign. But 14th Army is spread to the four winds precisely because of that fear of outflanking. So there's troops around Rome, there's troops north of Rome, there's troops around Genoa and La Spezia, which is a major military port. There's also troops around the Brenner Pass, the kind of main passageway from Italy into the Southern Reich. There's also troops around sort of Venice and the Veneto up in the kind of northeast of Italy as well. So, and they're spread over precisely for that reason. You know, that is why it's in that situation. So they're absolutely expecting it. And Kesselring has plans. Should the Allies invade, should they make a landing anywhere around Italy, there is instant plans for kind of, you know, with different code names that you trigger, you press the alarm button and everyone kicks into gear to respond to the landing south of Rome, to the landing north of Rome, to the landing around Genoa, all that kind of stuff. They've all got sort of groovy names like Richard and stuff like that. And and that's all in place for precisely that reason.
Yeah.
And Churchill understands that and understands that, you know, we need to play to our strengths. The problem is shipping. and particularly assault craft, and particularly amongst assault craft, landing ships. And there's two types of landing ships. There's LSIs, landing ship infantry.
Infantry.
And there's LSTs, which is landing ship tank.
Tank!
And LS are both of them are around 120 metres long. They're big old beasts, and they can carry a huge amount of material and literally land it on a beach.
How many infantry in an LSI?
1,500.
So you're putting basically...
Two battalions.
Well, yeah, exactly. So the best part of a brigade down, sharp, pointy end of a brigade.
Three LSIs, you've got a brigade.
Yeah, yeah, there we go.
And staff. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and, you know, nine LSIs, you've got a division. You know, that's unbelievable lift.
I mean, bloody hell.
Yeah. So we should just say what there is. So there's 246 assault craft in the Mediterranean at Christmas 1943, and there are 105 of the all-important landing ships. To put this in some comparison, there is 138 landing ships in total in the ETO, in the European Theatre of Operations, including the Mediterranean, and there are 144 in the Pacific. So the Pacific has the lion's share of
Germany
of landing
first.
Ships at this
yep.
point. Yeah. Yep. But it has been planned... Because the whole Italian campaign was supposed to be kind of Rome by Christmas, and then we can kind of sort of, you know, just push a little bit further north, and then we can stop worrying about it, and we'll just, all the focus is going to be on Overlord. It is planned that of the 246 assault craft and of those assault craft, those landing ships which are still in the Mediterranean, 68 of them will be leaving the Mediterranean on the 15th of January, which leaves just 37. And of those 37, 20 of them are scheduled to transport air forces to Corsica, which is now in Allied hands. Now, 15 are coming from the Pacific, or Southeast Asia, I should say, but they've been earmarked for an operation in Rhodes, in the island of Rhodes, in the Eastern Aegean, the Dodecanese, which is due to be taking place in some point in January, February. So on paper, you know, that makes Operation Shingle, this plan to land a core-sized force at Anzio, a complete non-starter. But Churchill, lying in bed, recovering from pneumonia in his villa in Carthage, which used to be Eisenhower's villa, is thinking... This is crazy. You know, we've got to be thinking, let's have another rethink on this. And so he summons Maitland Wilson, General Jumbo Maitland Wilson, who is soon to become Supreme Ally Commander in the Mediterranean, taking over from Eisenhower. He's British. And Alexander. And sat up in bed with his silk pyjamas and silk dressing gown, and with Wilson and Alexander perched on a corner each of the bed. They go through everything and discuss plans and work out how it could be possible. For Churchill, this is still about unlocking, you know, getting a force in and driving straight for Rome. For Alexander, this is all about unlocking the Gustav Line. And he accepts right from the word go that this is a punt. But he thinks maybe if we can put this big force behind the Gustav Line, maybe if we can kind of, you know, thrust out towards the Colli Lazali, which is part of the hills south of Rome, and get that high ground that's always so important, just so, you know, like 15 miles south of Rome, maybe that will unnerve the Germans so much that they will pull back, and then, you know, we've done it. And it's a perfectly reasonable assumption. I mean, it is a punt. It is a bet. It might not work. But Alexander also knows that if it doesn't work, you've got a very, very handy bridgehead behind the enemy lines for some other point. What Alexander's thinking is, we're committed now to the Italian campaign. We're here. You know, you chiefs of staff put us here. We've got lots of forces. Ultimately, it just might not be possible to get through the Gustav Line, but we'll give it a damn good go. I understand the urgency. We'll give it every crack we possibly can. I think, you know, Shingle, Operation Shingle, the Anzio landing's worth a punt, might not work, but at a later stage when the weather dries and we've got clearer skies and we can bring all our mechanisation to bear, how useful is that going to be, having that force behind the enemy lines?
Well, and also, you can't squeeze it all into to where the Gustav Line is anyway. That what do you do with these... That whole battle space is congested as it is because of the unsuitability of Italian roads and all that. So you might as well put them somewhere else, because you can't use them there, can you?
Yeah, there's some truth to that. There is some truth to that. But the other thing about it is that Alexander also knows, he implies it rather than explicitly saying it, but it's a very heavy implication, that if the chiefs of staff, combined chiefs of staff, commit to Operation Shingle, the invasion of Anzio, it might not achieve all its aims, but they will never let it fail.
Yeah.
You know, and what I mean by failure is being kicked back into the sea. That ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
So I think he feels this is another way of getting further commitment to the Italian campaign. And in that, he is surely absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Anyway, as a result of this Christmas Eve meeting, Churchill wins over Eisenhower, who still hasn't left at this point, and says, look, this is going to be really useful for Overlord. This is the best way of drawing off German troops. And you know what? He's absolutely right about that. I mean, you can say what you like about the Italian campaign, and you can argue the toss whether it should have happened in the first place. But if you want to draw off German troops for Overlord, keeping and when Hitler has decided that he wants to fight for every yard. So if Hitler's not going to accept retreats, there's only one way he's going to maintain that effort, and that is by drawing off more troops from elsewhere. And those troops have got to come from Germany, from France. And so when it comes to Operation Overlord, there's going to be fewer of them there. And that is absolutely inarguable. I mean, you know, he has two choices. He either fights or he retreats. And if he retreats, great, because then you get to Rome and, you know, you can then attack the Gothic line. And if he doesn't retreat, well, you know, it's bad, but at least you can hammer the Germans and kill lots of them, and you can draw off more German troops from elsewhere, because that's the only way they're going to be able to maintain that effort. And, you know, I don't want to do spoiler alert, but that's exactly what happens. So, you know, the thinking behind it is, I'm often get asked, you know, was Anzio the right decision? Yeah, it's absolutely the right decision. It's absolutely the right decision. Now, it doesn't, again, spoiler alert, it might not go 100% according to plan.
But it's the right move.
But it's the right decision.
Right.
The problem is how you get all those ducks in a row. So now you've got the kind of, you've got Eisenhower behind it. He then persuades FDR, Roosevelt, reluctantly. Chiefs of staff get behind it. They go, okay, fine. But, you know, we want to put some caveats on this. You know, all that shipping, those landing craft, we'll leave them a little bit longer, but they have to be on their way back to England by the 5th of, you know, nearly all of them have to be over on their way back to England and elsewhere by the 5th of February, which means drawing them out of Anzio by the 3rd of February. General Clark, who's overall in charge of this, because this is going to be his US 6th Corps, which is going to do the landing, which is actually going to be the US 3rd Infantry Division and the British 1st Division, which is yet to see action since Tunisia back in May. So first entry into the Italian campaign. He just goes, well, hang on a minute. You're asking me to do this crazy job. And he says, we're supposed to go up there, dump two divisions ashore with what core troops we can get in, with an inadequate number of craft, without supply or reinforcement, and wait for the rest of the army to join up. Are you mad? Is basically what he's saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's got a point, and he says, look, this is only going to work if we can have at least 20 landing ships to remain beyond the 3rd of February. Otherwise, we're out on a limb. You know, there's calculated risk and there's insanity, basically.
Yeah.
And this is where you start seeing where Alexander is really coming from, because Alexander goes, yep, hearing you loud and clear, let me go and put this to Winston. And he says, even if this does interfere with preparations for Anvil to some extent, surely the prize is worth it. So you can see him saying Anvil Schmanvil, because what's the point of Anvil? What's the point of Anvil?
Well, but the prize for Alex, arguably, in this situation is the chiefs of staff not letting Italy fail, isn't it? That's his prize, isn't it? He doesn't want the Italian campaign to wither on the vine and turn into this basically permanent stalemate, which it may well be drawing the Germans off.
Hang on,
just getting to that. He knows perfectly well as a general, what he cannot do is find himself in a permanent stalemate. There's no way to motivate your men if the idea is we're just going to sit here in some sort of locked, permanent position. And he's already got problems with morale, top to bottom. They all do in Italy. The Americans and the British and everyone. There is a morale question this winter, because the winter's so appalling and the theatre's very, very challenging. And he knows. I mean, obviously, all these things are inseparable. Strategic aims, political aims, and then in the end, how you motivate your army. Because if you have no political aim, you have no strategic aim, you will never motivate your men. You cannot say to soldiers, our job here is just to sit, wait, occupy the Germans, and that's how you're going to get killed and injured and maimed and go mad. No, that we're doing this in order to go forward to seize Rome, the glittering prize, the most famous city in the world, arguably, you know, and so on. And he knows that, but he also knows on a strategic level, he can't let the chiefs of staff. He wants to get the chiefs of staff to commit to a thing that they know they have to commit to permanently. There are two prizes in the word prize: Rome, and also, from his personal point of view, his theatre not withering on the vine, because otherwise he can't make his armies work. He cannot keep the thing going. The wheels will come off because he's not a German general. You know, he's not a German general who can crack the whip and demand every inch be fought for.
I think all of that is absolutely right. But I think it's even more than that, that they're in Italy. Why go to southern France when you're in Italy? Because, you know, well, it's economies of scale. You know, you've got everything set up. You've now got the docks at Naples working, at Brindisi and Bari. You've now got everything in place. You know, you've got vast arsenals and supply dumps and camps and field hospitals and all the rest of it. Why take it away from there for Anvil when you can achieve everything you want from Anvil in Italy?
In Italy.
So his point is, the whole point about Anvil is to draw troops away from Normandy, but also to potentially get into southern Germany from southern France. Well, Alexander's point is, but you can do that from northern Italy. You know, you can get into the Po Valley, and then you can decide whether you want to go over the Alps into France, or whether you want to go through the Ljubljana Gap and go into southern Austria. You know, it's strategically, that's keeping your options much more open. There is a kind of stubbornness about the Americans, which is nope, we want a grid, a strategy, and we want to stick to it. Whereas in Europe, at the European theatre, British approach is one which is much more kind of, let's kind of probe around, see what presents itself and exploit the weaknesses. You know, and it's not that one's right or one's wrong. It's just it's slightly a different approach. But that's why he wants to stay. It's not his own vanity for wanting to kind of stay in charge of the kind of main campaign, I don't think. I think it is because he thinks it makes the best military sense from a strategic point of view, operational point of view, and a tactical point of view too, having committed so far and so much already. And what he's absolutely committed to is getting north of Rome so that you can protect those Foggia airfields. And that he's, you know, I think that's, again, I don't really see how you can argue against that.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the strategic big picture here, with the players involved and their motivations, what they think they're trying to achieve. And the Gustav line, however, is the meat in this Allied sandwich. If the proposed, it's an open sandwich at the moment, isn't it? Because Fifth Army are going to close to the Gustav line.
We haven't decided whether we're going to have luncheon meat or whether we're going to have egg and cress.
Exactly, but Fifth Army are one piece of bread. Anzio is possibly the other piece of bread. Shingle is the other piece of bread that will then close the close the Gustav line. The salami, it's Italian meat. There we go.
Yeah, fair enough.
Although it's German salami in this instance. Anyway, so. In our next episode, in episode two, we will talk about how Fifth Army closes to the Gustav line, and because after all, at this point, they are still making their minds up about Anzio, and there isn't a firm decision on the cards. But what's got to happen, one way or another, is Fifth Army have to close to the Gustav line, which is 8 miles from the Bernhard line, and it's in our next episode. So thank you very much for listening. We will see you very soon. Subscribe to our Patreon, though, or our Apple channel if what you really, really want is to hear this immediately and without adverts. And don't forget, we have Ways Fest July the 18th to the 21st this year at Blackpit Brewery near Silverstone. We have waysfest.co.uk for your tickets for a weekend of this kind of unending rabbit holey waffle. We will see you very soon. Bye-bye.
Arrivederci.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.